The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Honourable Nikki Kaye.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by Cabinet's decision not to consider lifting alert level 2 restrictions and moving to level 1 until 8 June?
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the premise of that member's question is sadly incorrect. In fact, by choosing a decision date of 8 June, Cabinet decided to bring it forward from 22nd June. The member should be happy with the parties of this government and that they are cooperating to move as fast as we can on this important matter.
Supplementary question. Does she stand by her Cabinet paper that alert level 1 controls are predicated upon there having been no new cases from community transmission for at least 28 days?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, most definitely, accepting that was only one of 8 conditions set down at the time, and I'd invite that member to read the full paper before coming to this House with a not complete idea of what she's talking about.
Supplementary question. When was the last case of community transmission in New Zealand?
34 days ago.
Supplementary question. Does she stand by her statement yesterday that the criteria for decision-making on alert level 1 includes trends in the transmission of the virus and isn't the most significant trend the fact that there has been no community transmission in over a month?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, to the first question, most definitely stand by that statement. As to the second issue and question raised by the member, it is only one of the criteria that is being considered by the Cabinet on the 8th of June.
Supplementary question. Does the government have confidence in our border controls to enable the country to move to level 1?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, and I dare say the Minister of Customs and others here, we've done our best to secure and ensure that our borders are safe. That means it requires us to be extraordinarily vigilant. It requires us to cooperate with other countries as well. We have done everything we can, I believe, to ensure that when we come to make the decision, the security of our borders will not be one where we will be concerned about any failure or omission there.
Why has the Deputy Prime Minister failed to persuade her to move to level 1 immediately?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister is one of the most persuasive people I've met. However, I'll answer the question, Sunshine, when I get to it, all right? But the reality is that we belong to a coalition where cooperation and debate and discussion, sometimes heated, nevertheless leads to better decisions, not some discordant one-man band where the leader and the supporter is the same person.
Order. Before the member asks this, I let it run and then I've thought about it. I know that the term sunshine is a term of endearment, but it's probably not an appropriate one to use in the House.
David Seymour.
Sorry, Grandpa. Is she aware of the reasons why, after calling for an immediate move
of order, Tracy Martin?
As the Minister for Seniors, I object to the ageist phrase that member just used before he started his question.
Did the member use an ageist phrase?
Mr. Speaker, as you said earlier, it's a term of endearment.
The member heard a warning as to the inappropriateness of using terms, even if they were of endearment, and if he deliberately used a term of endearment, then I'm striking the question out.
Oh, Mr. Speaker, I wasn't deliberate.
Well, if the member ignorantly used one, I'm striking it out as well.
Nikki Kaye. The Honourable Nikki Kaye.
Point of order, Mr.
Speaker. A point of order, David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, you frequently allow other members to ask their question, even after cautioning them about their conduct. To take a question away on that basis is grossly unfair, and it undermines this House being able to hold the government accountable.
Okay, the member will resume his seat. The member through an arrangement with another member, has had double the questions that he normally has had this week. And if he is serious about holding the House to account, he will, especially after a warning's been issued, stay within standing orders and Speaker's rulings. He deliberately flouted them, and for members who deliberately flout them, there are consequences, and for members on both sides of the House, as both whips will indicate, I do regularly take questions from parties who deliberately breach the rules or ignorantly breach the rules, as that member did. Nikki Kaye. I'm not going to have the subject debated again.
Fresh point of order, Mr. Speaker.
On a different issue?
Yes. I seek leave to ask an additional supplementary question.
Is there any objection to that?
There is. Oh.
All right. Member will leave the chamber. The Honourable Nikki Kaye.
Supplementary question. Why are we not at level one when her cabinet paper states there is no need for restrictions if there is no community transmission for 28 days and we have confidence in our border controls?
Again, the reality is, and I set it out, that there are 8 criteria, not one. Now I've heard of, now thus far, in these, all these submitted questions, I've heard of 2 of the pathways of judgment, not the other 6. But if we wait here long enough, maybe I'll belt down the other 6 as well.
Supplementary question. What is the reason the Deputy Prime Minister gave her for wanting to move to level 1 over a week ago?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister came along and said, we have 2 cycles target, we're going to meet that. There are other things that we are going to have to focus on, such as border security and a range of other matters as well, including the effectiveness of an app and community awareness and cooperation. But the reality, but the Deputy Prime Minister above all stressed that it was the economy and its turnaround and recovery that was so critical in his thinking, and that was put before her as the Prime Minister.
Supplementary question. Is one of the reasons that she has not moved the country into level one the reason articulated by the Honourable Willie Jackson about alert levels, that another week is not going to hurt?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, no, it's not that at all, but the Prime Minister, you recall, just 3 days ago, I was listening to another leader of another party who said he didn't and couldn't take a position on alert level one because he isn't the Prime Minister, in the quotes. Now, I don't know where that member is getting her leadership from, but that's what the then and now and new National Party leadership said.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
To the Prime Minister, does she believe that there would be an increased risk of community transmission taking hold in New Zealand again if we moved to reopen the border with urgency to countries like China, as advocated by the Leader of the Opposition?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, that is an extremely good question because it demonstrates how dangerous the thinking of some people is. Because if we were to do that, then who would know, according to one of the 8 criteria laid out, how sound our border was? And I actually was astonished when I heard it, and I still don't believe that someone honestly could have put it forward as a sound add to the Tasman bubble, that proposition.
Supplementary question. Does she agree with either Willie Jackson or Wellington pub owner Matt McLaughlin, who says his bar Danger Danger is still in a world of hurt at level 2?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, of course, the Prime Minister sympathises with every businessman and woman who, because of this outside intruder, has suffered so much. Everybody on this side of the House understands that, and that's why we're doing our best to get back to normalcy as fast as we possibly can, and possibly 2 weeks earlier than originally projected. But here's the real point. We are not going to use the misery of people caused by some outside influence for which none of us are responsible, just to try and advance our miserable political careers.
Supplementary question. Why did she not listen to her Deputy Prime Minister and the thousands of businesses across New Zealand that are hurting as a result of not being in level one?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, she almost had me there. But I've got to say that it is a decision to be made by all of Cabinet, and all of Cabinet will be listening to the country at the same time.
Question number two, Dr. Deborah Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Research, Science and Innovation. What recent announcements has she made about funding for the research, science and innovation sector?
The Honourable Dr. Megan Woods.
Thank you. Yesterday I had the pleasure of visiting the Institute of Environmental Science and Research campus at Kenepuru to announce over $400 million in funding for the research, science and innovation sector from Budget 2020 and the COVID Response and Recovery Fund. Crown Research Institutes will receive $196 million in additional funding so they can retain talent and continue their key research. A $33 million fund will enable Māori to determine and make further investments in research, science and innovation priorities, and $150 million has been made available for a loan scheme helping R&D intensive firms retain critical capability and talent and maintain their important research. This government recognises the critical importance of a strong and well-resourced science sector and has stepped up to the plate with funding that will see that necessary work continue.
How will this funding boost support the post-COVID economic recovery?
Mr. Speaker, scientists have been at the coalface of the immediate COVID-19 response, and their critical capability will need to be maintained as more research is undertaken into the virus itself and as global efforts coalesce in the hunt for a vaccine. These investments will support the production of high-value products, knowledge-intensive, high-paying jobs, and help New Zealand make a strong recovery from COVID-19. It will provide certainty to our entrepreneurs, innovators and researchers that this government backs them and their work and will not repeat the mistakes of the past, particularly following the GFC, by cutting funding to the sciences in response to an economic downturn.
What other announcements has the government made to assist entrepreneurs, innovators and researchers in response to COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, the government moved swiftly to establish the $25 million COVID Innovation Acceleration Fund designed to accelerate the deployment of rapidly standing solutions in response to the threats posed by COVID-19. The ingenuity of the applications has to date been impressive, and I look forward to seeing how these solutions can be utilised in our ongoing response and recovery. And of course, the Ministers of Foreign Affairs, Health and I also recently announced a vaccine strategy for New Zealand, which will see $37 million of government funded provided for the development of diagnostics, vaccines and treatments for COVID-19, as well as participation in international efforts and support for our Pacific neighbours.
Question number three, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Does he stand by all his statements and policies?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Yes, in the context they were made and delivered, including my statement welcoming the opposition's stated policy of, quote, moving away from the non-specific do you stand by all your policies and statements questions, and my latest statement at 11 a.m. this morning expressing regret that the member missed the memo.
Supplementary. Does he stand by his response to my question on Tuesday, which asked how much additional spending he had so far planned to announce before the general election in September? Quote, as the member knows, the government has been very flexible all the way through our response to ensure we meet need as it arises, but I don't have any specific plans in that regard.
Mr. Speaker, I stand by all of the statements I made in that answer, and I think the member's impression wasn't too bad just then.
Well, how did he not have any specific plans for new spending on Tuesday and then have his government announce $400 million of new spending on Wednesday?
Mr. Speaker, the basis of that spending was in the budget and the CRRF announcements we made.
Why can't he give a straight answer to the question of how much additional spending he has planned to announce before the election, when he clearly has large spending announcements planned for virtually every day?
Mr. Speaker, I do find it difficult to give straight answers. sometimes anyway, for obvious reasons. Only you and I are getting this joke, Mr. Speaker, but it's good that the two of us are sharing in it anyway. Mr. Speaker, we've been very clear that we've announced $30 billion worth of spending from the Response and Recovery Fund. The remaining $20 billion is available for spending as necessary. It doesn't mean it won't be spent, but it doesn't mean that all of it will be spent either.
Does he think he can just dismiss questions about his intentions for billions of dollars of spending?
Mr. Speaker, no, and I haven't.
Can he assure New Zealanders that he'll keep a substantial part of the $20 billion spare from the COVID fund as a contingency in the case of a later outbreak?
Mr. Speaker, I in fact talked exactly about that when I announced it on Budget Day. I note that the member and his party have already tried to spend about $10 billion of it in the last 2 weeks.
How long is he planning to keep up his average of announcing $200 million of new spending a day since the budget, and how does he think New Zealand will pay for it?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I would have to go back and look at the figures that the member has just put forward there. What we have done throughout the last 2.5 months or so is done what New Zealanders wanted us to do, which is cushion the blow of this virus on both our economy and our society, and we'll keep doing that.
Question number four, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Transport. What is in the text of the email from the office of Right Honourable Winston Peters to him on Auckland Light Rail, and will Auckland Light Rail be considered by Cabinet before the pre-election period begins on 19 June 2020?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
Mr. Speaker, my office received an email from the office of the Leader of New Zealand First on Auckland Light Rail as part of coalition consultation. It's not in the public interest to disclose cross-party discussions during the Cabinet decision-making process. And to the second part of the question, that is my intention.
Did the email contain an attachment, and did that attachment contain a letter on ministerial letterhead?
I actually haven't seen the actual email myself, but my staff have dealt with it, so I can't answer that member's question.
Sorry, is he saying that the office of the Right Honourable Winston Peters, in his capacity of the Leader of New Zealand First Party, has sent him an email about the Auckland Light Rail project and he hasn't seen the email?
So the email was sent by staff in the Leader of New Zealand First's office, and it went to my staff and has been dealt with accordingly.
Given the importance of Auckland Light Rail, in his own words, to the government's program for Auckland, why has he not seen the email from the office of the Leader of New Zealand First relating to that project?
Because ministers have staff who deal with these things, and I've been briefed by my staff on what's in the email.
When was the email sent to his office?
The email was sent on the 29th of February.
Would it be fair to say that the email, albeit that he hasn't seen, was a contributing factor to Auckland Light Rail not going to Cabinet in February, as was agreed by Cabinet in June 2019?
No.
Question number four, Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development. What recent information has she seen on the impact of the wage subsidy on employers?
Mr. Speaker, I have recently seen preliminary findings on a survey of businesses receiving the government wage subsidy. The survey had high engagement with over 90,000 respondents, around a 25% response rate. The survey asked 13 questions on the following topics: the impact of COVID-19 on businesses, the efficacy of the wage subsidy, awareness and uptake of the supports and services available to them through government, and likely future support needs. It has been heartening to hear the positive responses of businesses that have seen the wage subsidy as a crucial lifeline, with 79% of respondents saying they had benefited a lot from the subsidy.
What are some of the other preliminary findings from the survey?
Mr. Speaker, one of the highlights has been seeing that the vast majority of respondents said that the wage subsidy had a positive impact on cash flow, 94%, staff retention, 83%, and being able to keep operating for the foreseeable future, so 89%. Over half, 62%, also said that support for wages has helped employers address other non-staff overheads. It was also a positive sign that only around 6% of respondents were expecting to make staff redundant over the coming months, and saying that I acknowledge that larger firms indicated a higher likelihood of staff impacts than small to medium-sized businesses. These results show that for the vast majority of respondents, the wage subsidy is achieving its intended purpose with broader positive benefits, and we look forward to how we can use these insights to support businesses into the future.
How will the findings of the survey support the government's response to COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, the final survey results will include important demographic information such as industry, regional spread, financial turnover, revenue from tourism, and whether the business identifies even as Māori or Pacific business. This will be useful as we try to understand the broader impact of the wage subsidy, particularly on small businesses across regions and industries. More than this, it gives an insight into what businesses are thinking their next steps might be and where the government can improve our support moving forward. For instance, the preliminary results show that there was less awareness around some of the other supports available to businesses, like non-government business support from councils and chambers of commerce. Over the coming weeks, we hope to learn everything we can from this feedback, and we expect to be able to share a more fulsome range of findings when the final results are available next week.
Question number six, the Honourable Michael Waterhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. Does he stand by his statement that, quote, no government had ever set up a national contact tracing system? The steps forward in terms of the IT solution that supports that is going to be incredibly valuable as we move into the future, end quote.
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Well, is it concerning to him that half the country's district health boards, including those in Auckland where the biggest outbreaks occurred, are not using his, quote, incredibly valuable, end quote, IT solution?
Mr. Speaker, what I can confirm is that all of our PHUs are for the first time using digital platforms for contact tracing. Up until the creation of the National Close Contact Service and the National Contact Tracing Solution, many PHUs were using manual systems. The first priority was addressing that and ensuring we could gather accurate and timely national data on contact tracing. That has been achieved.
When Dr. Aisha Verrill stated in Recommendation 6 of her Rapid Audit report that, quote, the Ministry of Health should give public health units access to the National Contact Tracing Solution, end quote, would it have been her expectation that public health units actually use it?
Mr. Speaker, she's probably best to speak to her expectation, but it is the case that all of the PHUs have access to the data in that solution.
The Minister's expectation that having spent $55 million of taxpayers' money on a technology solution, that technology should be used by all public health units.
Mr. Speaker, it is my expectation that over time those public health units that are not currently connected directly into all features of that system be integrated. I think the member would be both surprised and impressed to know that a technology solution has been set up in a matter of months to achieve this, that everybody has a connection to it, and in fact that the historic underinvestment in our health system has been rapidly rectified, because this is a government that is committed to public health, in contrast to the prior government, which cut public health funding by a whopping 26%, a whopping 26% cut in public health funding. We have invested in solutions which are ensuring that everyone is digitally connected and can get the data in a timely fashion.
Was the Prime Minister correct when she said in the House that compliance is a factor considered for the move to Alert Level 1? And is non-compliance with the Verrill Report recommendations one reason we're not already there?
Mr. Speaker, In answer to the first part of the member's question, yes. In answer to the second part of the question, of course, all of those different PHUs are connected into the system. They are able to access the data and they are required to report into the central solution. So, I mean, at the moment, it is rather easy to read the zeros in the spreadsheet. And that is thanks to the good efforts of New Zealanders who've made considerable sacrifice along the way. But it's also thanks to the efforts of our public health staff across the country, our doctors and nurses and others who've contributed to this extraordinary success. And I think the member would do better to congratulate them and thank them rather than talking down their superhuman efforts.
Question number seven, Matt Ducey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health and asks, how much of the $455 million for the government's new frontline mental health service announced in Budget 2019 has been spent to date, and how many of the 22 delivery sites identified in his Anzac Day press release were providing these services before the government announced its new frontline mental health services in Budget 2019?
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, as the member knows, the $455 million investment in Budget 2019 was over 4 years, with spending ramping up over time as new workforces are trained and new services developed. I'm advised that as of 30 April, approximately $20 million has been spent, despite the disruption caused by the COVID-19 global pandemic. This has funded the continuation of services that were previously being trialled at 22 sites, giving them certainty of funding for the first time. It also includes some funding for the next stage of the rollout, which is seeing new services established in 100 new sites by the middle of next year, serving a population of 1.5 million people. As the member will be aware, additional funding was also allocated and spent for the psychosocial response to COVID.
Supplementary. So is the Minister telling the House today, after announcing almost $500 million in Budget 2019 for his new flagship frontline mental health service...
Member will resume a seat. The member will ask a question.
Is the Minister telling the House today, after promising almost $500 million, he has only spent $20 million to date?
Mr. Speaker, the flagship policy is, of course, rolling out over 5 years, as I explained to the member, both in the budget, it's in the budget documents, and also recently in debates in this House. There are now services being delivered in around 40 practices across 11 DHBs, with more to come. It's quite impressive how quickly these things have rolled out. 1.5 million New Zealanders by the middle of next year will have access to these services, and that's on top of the other new programs that this government has delivered, including Mana Ake, which has helped more than 5,000 primary and intermediate aged children in Canterbury and Kaikoura, Piki, which is providing free mental health and wellbeing support to 18 to 24 year olds in Wellington and Wairarapa, more nurses in schools, and so on. A number of new services have also been stood up as a part of this government's response. This is a government that takes mental health seriously.
Supplementary. Supplementary, if the Minister is impressed how quickly the service has been rolled out, how come he has told the House today that his 22 sites, his mental health service has been delivered for, was being delivered before his announcement, so in the last year he has delivered a net gain of zero new sites?
The member might want to look more closely at my answer. By the middle of next year, 1.5 million people will have access to new services. Currently, there are 40 sites delivering those services. That is not a net increase of zero.
If the Minister allocated just under $50 million for the first year rollout of the new flagship frontline mental health service, Why is he so proud in the House today that he's only spent $20 million of that?
Mr. Speaker, of course we want to continue to build on what we're doing, but unfortunately our mental health services were sorely neglected under the previous government. We have built new services with Mana Ake in Canterbury and Kaikoura. We have built new services for young people with Piki. Also during the COVID period, of course, there was some delays, but not a great deal. And so some of those services will continue to be rolled out in the next couple of months that were delayed because of the Piki situation. The COVID situation. And on top of that, new services, psychosocial responses and online services were rolled out during the COVID period that were not previously anticipated, including the Getting Through Together website, which has had 34,000 unique visitors to the end of April, the Sparklers at Home website, which has had 47,000 unique visitors to the 23rd of April, the Mentimia app, which has had 35,000 downloads, the Mellon Health app, which has had over 1,000 people signed up to it in its first 2 weeks of operation, and the Staying on Track e-therapy course developed by the WISE Group, which has also had over 1,000 people registered in its first 3 weeks of operation. No doubt more have signed up to those services since. But during the COVID period, we stood up additional things that were in addition to those other flagship policies which continue to roll out. I'm very proud of the work that our mental health services people are delivering for New Zealanders after years and years of neglect. This government is absolutely committed to improving mental health and well-being of New Zealanders, and we stand by our record of growing services and working towards a free service that will be available in 5 years for all New Zealanders.
Supplementary question. Does the Minister agree that spending only $20 million of the announced half a billion, a net gain today we hear of only 20 new sites, is not the level of service New Zealanders were promised by the Health Minister a year ago?
Speaker, I think the member misunderstands the budget documents. The plan was not to spend the $500 million all at once in the first year when there was no workforces available to deliver it. It was to spend some in the first year to build up workforces and capacity in the sector and to continue to build. We're building a whole new workforce because the previous government ignored mental health. The previous government ignored mental health. We have had to start and build a new workforce because we believe it is important to take mental health seriously and build a free service that all New Zealanders can access. And it's a shame that the previous government is criticising that effort and talking down the efforts of those people who are working hard to deliver that new service for New Zealanders.
Talking down you. Supplementary. Does the Minister agree with News Hub Nation reporter Simon Shepherd, who said after the Minister's interview on Anzac Day about its announcement for the flagship frontline mental health service, this has got a slight Kiwi build flavour about it. If they haven't managed to roll it out yet, and it's a year after actually announcing, end quote.
Mr. Speaker, I haven't seen that quote, but the truth is that there was a huge period of neglect for mental health services under the previous government. If that's what the housing record's about, because the previous government's housing record was shocking too, then I can see where he's coming from. But what I would say is that we're absolutely committed to a new mental health service and to putting right the historic wrong where mental health was disregarded by the previous government, where they canned the Mental Health Commission, just got rid of it, where they failed to fund the growing demand in mental health services and left it on the back burner. They opposed a review of mental health services. We had Hayata Oranga and put that in place. We built new services even while that review was going on in Mana Ake, in Canterbury and Kaikoura in response to the earthquakes. We built new services in Piki for our young people. We've put nurses in schools across New Zealand. We will continue to build our mental health services because for this government, it is a priority. This government is taking mental health seriously, and we're very proud of that.
Supplementary. In response to the Minister's answer about the Ada Oranga, the Mental Health Inquiry recommendations, what does the Minister say to the Mental Health Foundation, who after Budget 2020 said that they had concerns there was no resourcing or implementation plan for the recommendations of He Ada Oranga? Without a plan, we are concerned that progress will stall and drift.
End quote.
No, that does not relate to the original question.
Mr. Speaker.
Further supplementary? A point of order, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Mr. Speaker, the very essence of the Budget 19 allocations that Mr. Ducey's primary question was related to was in response to the recommendations of the very report that he mentioned as supplementary. I can't see how it can't be related.
Well, the member in his original question and in the supplementaries referred on a number of occasions to the 2019 budget allocation and the spending of that. He then shifted to the 2020 budget. Now, I'm actually just about prepared to change my mind and ask the member to have say the question again, but I will say that I have been watching Mr. Woodhouse in particular getting unhappy with the lengths of the answers that have been coming from the Minister at the moment. But I will say that when a very political question is asked, and there have been a long series of these from this member, one can expect extensive and political replies. Matt.
The point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Well, I've dealt with the point of order.
You made a description of what was going on in my head, and I think I have the right to at least contextualise that saying...
That's fair enough.
..that if I was sufficiently unhappy with the way in which that answer was going, I would have drawn it to your attention, and I did not.
Well, that's... I apologise. I was reading the member's repeated body language. Matt Ducey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My supplementary was, what does the Minister say in responding to the Mental Health Foundation's comments about Budget 2020 announcement when the Minister referenced Hei Ara Oranga? They went on to say, quote, no resourcing or implementation plan for the recommendations of Hei Ara Oranga. Without a plan, we are concerned that progress will stall and drift, end quote. It doesn't add up.
Mr. Speaker, I respectfully disagree because an extensive government plan has been outlined. We have continued to invest in mental health services, even those beyond Hei Ara Oranga, and all of those psychosocial responses I've outlined in my earlier answers, in the responses to during the COVID period, and also in the additional monies that have been set aside. Now, I believe over $300 million per annum in the mental health ring fence. That number continues to grow year by year as we put record amounts into our DHBs for strengthening specialist services as well. There has been a long, long period of neglect. We have planned carefully as a government because we take mental health seriously.
Question number 8, Jan Tinetti.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Education. What action is the government taking to pave the way for a fully qualified early learning workforce?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, as part of Budget 2020, we are restoring the 100% funding ban for teacher-led early childhood education services that employ fully qualified and registered teachers. The funding ban was scrapped by the previous government in 2010. The new 100% funding rates will apply from the 1st of January 2021. This takes the government's drive to improve the quality of early childhood education another step forward. Reinstating the 100% funding ban is one of the top action points in the 10-year early learning action plan that the government has released.
Will this change support the sector to manage the financial impact of COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, yes, it will. This funding boost comes at a time when there's likely to be lower demand for early learning services. The new funding ban will encourage centres to use fully trained teachers and to keep the fully trained teachers that they have in work. As we respond to the challenges of COVID-19 and rebuild together, it's vitally important that this sector, who work with our youngest New Zealanders, is funded properly. A decade of underfunding has had a significant impact on the sector, which is why early childhood education was our top education priority in this year's budget.
What response has he seen to the restoration of the 100% funding ban?
Mr. Speaker, the New Zealand Kindergartens has said that this is just so exciting for us and has been a long time coming. It's such good news off the back of what we've been going through with COVID-19 and a great boost in recognition to our staff who have been working so hard during this time to support our tamariki and our community. The Early Childhood Council has applauded the government for reinstating the spend, saying, quote, "We're delighted to see two sizeable investments within a week after several years of ECE underfunding." And, Mr Speaker, it is with great humility that I saw the comment from the NZEI, who said, "The Minister signed a pledge before the last election to restore this funding, so we're really pleased to see him follow through and make early childhood education a top priority after a decade of neglect that's gone before."
Question number 9, Andrew Bailey.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Justice. Has the government done enough to help support commercial landlords and business owners meet the costs they have incurred from COVID-19?
Speaker.
Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr Speaker, the government is implementing a far-reaching plan to respond, recover and rebuild from COVID-19 in a way that supports business. Treasury has forecast up to 140,000 jobs saved as a result of that plan, and employment growth of 370,000 jobs over the next 4 years from our range of measures, which includes the wage subsidy, the small business loan scheme, our record investment in infrastructure, tax measures and so on. This is the government of small business and we are the party of small business. In relation to commercial landlords and tenants, this morning I announced the second stage of our support package in the commercial lease space that will support Kiwi businesses to resolve commercial rent disputes and seek rent relief by amending the Property Law Act and providing up to $40 million for access to arbitration. So, in summary, and to answer the member's question, yes.
Why has it taken 69 days since lockdown for the government to announce its policy when tenants and landlords have already had to agree to three cycles of rental payments covering April, May and June?
Mr Speaker, I'm not sure that tenants agree to rental payments apart from when they reach their lease agreement. But nevertheless, the Coalition Government put together a proposal roughly 5 weeks ago. It has been the subject of intense scrutiny by the partners in government, and we have reached agreement and announced our policy today.
What advice has he received on the financial impact?
Order.
On...
Start again. I won't punish the member. I've received no advice, Mr Bailey.
What advice has the Minister received on the financial impact on mum and dad investors who own a large proportion of commercial property in New Zealand when they are required to reduce their rent following a disputes process?
Mr Speaker, the package that we've announced today actually deals with the situation of businesses that are owned by mum and dad investors, as he describes it, and who are tenants, and who are having difficulty reaching agreement with their landlord on rent relief during a period where their businesses have effectively been closed down and they've lost all their revenue. But the package also applies to landlords who might be described as vulnerable landlords, who are small mum and dad investors, but with big corporate tenants, and whose corporate tenants have said, we're just not going to pay rent anymore. So they will have access to this process through a compulsory arbitration arrangement where they can get some justice.
Rather than offering a $40 million policy that effectively pays arbitrators to run a disputes process, why didn't he simply give small businesses cash?
Mr Speaker, it was important that when you understand the nature of small business in New Zealand, which is that it is highly diversified, highly variable, that we put in place a package of measures that enables tenants and landlords to come to terms dealing with the extraordinary range of situations and circumstances that they have. This does not call for a one-size-fits-all solution.
Question number 10, Brett Hudson.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Police. Does he expect that police will enforce the rules related to the COVID-19 alert levels?
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Mr Speaker, I expect police to apply the discretion that they are given under the law when undertaking enforcement activities.
Supplementary. What advice, if any, has the Minister requested on the enforcement of the COVID-19 restrictions in relation to a tangi held on April 30th in Dunedin and events in the days leading up to it that saw dozens of patched gang members travel within the district in breach of Level 4 conditions?
None.
Supplementary. Does he believe that this tangi and the events in the 9 days leading up to it broke the rules set down to assist New Zealand's COVID-19 response?
Mr Speaker, it's not what I believe, but I do have confidence in the Commissioner of Police to ensure his officers enforce COVID-19... Sorry, Dr Smith? Oh, turn it up, you bloody loser. Enforce COVID-19 restrictions appropriately.
Supplementary. To the Minister, why are police willing to issue warnings to members of the public for suspected breaches such as having a cup of tea at the end of their respective driveways with neighbours, but not gang members who clearly breached COVID-19 rules?
Mr Speaker, police have no record of any reports or complaints being made with regard to the incident that the member alluded to.
Question number 11, Gareth Hughes.
Hey, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Women and asks, what has the government done to address period poverty in schools?
The Honourable Julian Jenner.
Mr Speaker, tēnā koutou, Mr Speaker, tēnā koutou e te
kore. Greetings to all gathered in the House. Thank you, Mr Speaker.
To 15 schools in the Waikato following the government's $2.6 million investment announced yesterday. The rollout will be expanded to all state and state integrated schools on an opt-in basis in 2021. Periods are a fact of life for half the population, and access to these products is a necessity, not a luxury.
Is it acceptable in modern New Zealand that, according to a KidsCan survey from 2018, one-third of 15 to 17-year-olds who responded said they'd miss school because they didn't have access to period products?
Mr. Speaker, no one should miss school because they have had their period and don't have access to the products they need. We know that nearly 95,000 9 to 18-year-olds may stay at home during their periods due to not being able to afford period products. By making them freely available, we support these young people to continue learning and participating at school.
Will reusable products be available, and how will this initiative consider the environment?
I'm very happy to say that environmental sustainability will be considered in the program. While the pilot will start with disposable pads and tampons, they will be plastic-free, and there may be scope to include other types of reusable products in the program in the future if there is high demand for them.
Has the Minister seen reports of families choosing food over period products for children, and is the government acting now as part of its focus on child poverty?
Yes, and no family should have to choose between food or period products in a wealthy country like Aotearoa New Zealand. Ensuring that every school child has the period products they need is another step towards our goal of eliminating child poverty. I am pleased our government is finding ways of helping children and young people at a time when every extra bit of assistance makes a difference. I also want to thank the researchers and the campaigners who have highlighted the issue of unaffordability of period products for some families and the subsequent absence from school for some children and young people. This was a win for those campaigners.
Question number 12, Simeon Brown.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Corrections. Is he satisfied with the decisions and actions made by the Department of Corrections during COVID-19?
The Honourable Kelvin Davis.
Mr Speaker, unlike many other countries around the world, here in New Zealand we were able to keep COVID-19 from breaking out in our prisons. That was due to the strict health and safety measures we put in place and the ability of corrections to implement measures like social distancing in what is a very, very complex environment. I made clear from the outset that my expectation was that a prisoner's lawful rights were to be upheld regardless of the situation. In seeking further assurance around this matter, I asked corrections to undertake a national review of their compliance with the minimum prisoner entitlement of 1 hour of daily exercise. This found that 96% of people in prison had received their minimum entitlement or more. In the other 4% of the cases, decisions were made in line with prisoner operation manual guidance.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. How many offenders have had release conditions varied or discharged by probation officers whilst the Epidemic Preparedness, Epidemic Management, COVID-19 Parole Act 2002 and Sentencing Act 2002 Notice 2020 was in force?
Well, Mr. Speaker, that's a very specific question. Corrections doesn't have the ability to release prisoners. That is either up to a judge when they're hearing bail conditions or the parole board, or a prisoner reaches the end of their statutory, the statutory release date.
Offenders had community service hours remitted by probation officers whilst the epidemic preparedness notice was in force?
Well, Mr. Speaker, it's very difficult for prisoners to, for offenders in the community to do hours when they're in lockdown. So the situation was made so that they could do their hours post-lockdown.
Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What effect, if any, did COVID-19 have on the Minister's goal of reducing the prison population safely by 30% over 15 years?
Well, Mr. Speaker, no matter how you look at it, the prison population is safely reducing, meaning we are well on track to achieve our goals. Last week, the Ministry of Justice released its updated prison population projections. In 2017, under the previous government, those projections showed that in 2020, the prison population could reach over 12,000. The 2019 projections showed that number dropping to around 10,000. The actual number of prisoners is today 9,530. That is down from a peak of 10,800. In 20, we did say that we would try to safely reduce the prison population by 30% over 15 years. So just to be crystal clear, because the member opposite got a little confused between projections and actual numbers last week, projected numbers of prisoners have dropped by around 2,000. Actual numbers of prisoners have dropped by 1,290.
Well done. Supplementary on the actual question, is he telling the House that the
order,
COVID...
Order. I think what I'm going to rule is that there were offences on both sides, and I'm going to ask the member to start his question again without the additional comment. I'll say to members on the government side, if they hadn't interjected, it would have been the end of the question.
Is he telling the House that the COVID-19 lockdown was for everyone except for those who had their release conditions varied or community service sentences remitted?
No.
The Honourable David Parker.
Is the Minister able to confirm that the justice system, including corrections, went to a great deal of effort in order to ensure that parole hearings still took place during the COVID lockdown period using audiovisual facilities?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I can confirm that. I mean, as I said in the answer to my primary question, it was a very, very complex situation. Corrections has done a fantastic job of making sure that prisoners and offenders' cases were still heard and that justice was seen to be done.
Very good. That concludes oral questions.